Apartheid, the strict separation of the races in South Africa, brought the disapproval and condemnation of the world down upon it. Many workers from other countries went to South Africa to help the people and help the process of ending apartheid. And it was in the waning days of apartheid that an American woman was killed by a mob. Several men went to prison for the murder, but not for long. Why, you ask? Our guest this hour answers that question and many more of her own. Justine van der Leeuwen is the author of We Are Not Such Things. Justine is an American writer who lived in South Africa. Her stories and articles have appeared in a wide variety of publications, from the New Yorker Observer to the Oprah magazine O. Justine is also the author of the travel memoir Marcus of Umbria. Justine van der Leeuwen, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us about your interest in going back to investigate the Amy Beale case. What was hanging out there that didn't quite add up for you?
In fact, it did add up for me at the beginning. This book is actually the result of a somewhat unexpected investigation that came out of a desire just to tell this story that's very well known in South Africa, not so well known here. I wanted to tell the story of Amy Beale, which I can elaborate on, and sort of give it more details and more depth. When I started to look at the accepted story, it fell apart, and that is how the investigation led to this book, which is very different than the initial book I was planning to write.
And what does the title mean, We Are Not Such Things?
So of the men that were arrested, so just a little background, is that Amy Beale was a 26-year-old white American Fulbright scholar, quite brilliant, very pretty, quite beloved, who went after Stanford to South Africa to do her fellowship and to help usher in the sort of inevitable new inclusive democracy that was coming in 1994. She was there in 1993. On one of her last days there, she was there for almost a year, she gave a couple black friends a ride back to a township, the historically all-black areas that are outside of the major cities. So she gave these friends a ride, despite there being a lot of upheaval then. It was August 25th, 1993, in the waning days. And she sort of drove right into a protest by some students and just some young people aligned with a militant political group. They were shouting a slogan, "One Settler, One Bullet," which you can guess means,
settlers meaning white people in this case?
Settlers are, not technically all white people. It was really the Europeans. I think that's what they meant. Amy Beale wouldn't have been a settler in their understanding of it if they had known who she was, but they saw her white skin and they sort of took her down and ended up dragging her out of the car, stoning and stabbing her to death. That was big in the news, and they went to prison after a long trial. Four young men went to prison after a long trial. And then in the later 1990s, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is a sort of restorative justice body, came into being. And these men went before it, and to get amnesty, you had to prove that your action, what had gotten you into prison, was politically motivated. And if you told the whole truth about it, and you could prove that it was motivated by politics, whatever side of the spectrum you were on, you could get amnesty. You're this clean slate. You would be let out of prison. So these men who had been arrested went before the commission, and at the commission, it was a sort of extrajudicial body, but it was set up like a trial, and there was, they had lawyers, hired by their political group, arguing that they were politically motivated. And then there was a state lawyer whose job was to argue that they were not politically motivated and therefore would have to stay in prison. So the state lawyer said to Easy Nofamela, who is the main character of this book, "You see what I am going to suggest to you, Mr. Nofamela, is that the attack and brutal murder of Amy Beale could not have been done with a political objective. It was wanton brutality, like a pack of sharks smelling blood. Isn't that the truth?" And Easy answered, "No, that's not true. That's not true. We are not such things." And that's where I got the title from.
Oh, okay. Okay, that makes sense. So Interesting. So the judge was trying to lead Easy into an answer that Easy didn't give.
The state lawyer was doing his job. He was acting as sort of a prosecutor in a way. Mm-hmm. So he was trying to prove to him, you know, this was just, you know, a criminal act. There was nothing political about it, and you were just animals who jumped upon her. And Easy reacted very strongly to that.
So what happened to Easy and the other three men who were convicted through this commission process?
So they were brought before the Amnesty Commission in 1987, and what was particularly remarkable at the case is that Amy Beale's parents came from America, and they said to the country, "We support your process." Many of the families of people who had been killed or injured or, you know, had human rights violations against them would go to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and would argue against somebody getting freed or amnestied. But Amy Beale's parents went and they said, "We support this process, and whatever South Africa decides to do to go forward, we support it," which was very remarkable. And they shook hands with some of the parents of the men who had been convicted. They said, "We are parents too. We stand with you." And they were a very strong presence there. And in the end, these four young men who had been convicted were given amnesty a year after the hearings.
All right, we'll follow this up further and find out more of some of the things that Justine van der Leeuwen wrote about in We Are Not Such Things. It's about the murder of Amy Beale in South Africa in the early 90s, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission essentially shortening the sentences of the four men convicted of her murder just a few years later, and the fact that the story fell apart upon further examination by Justine. We'll talk more with her about all the things she found out and come back to the Jefferson Exchange to take phone calls and emails from you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the American writer Justine van der Leeuwen, who has written a book about her odyssey in South Africa, tracing the murder in the early 90s of Amy Beale, an American worker who was killed apparently by a mob in the waning days of apartheid. Four men were convicted of the murder. They came before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission just a few years later, and their sentences were shortened by quite a bit. And Justine went back and looked further into the story and found a lot of things not adding up. Her book is called We Are Not Such Things, The Murder of a Young American, a South African Township, and the Search for Truth and Reconciliation. You can join this discussion as any discussion on the Jefferson Exchange. Your thoughts, comments, questions, welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to back up just a bit, Justine, to your own personal experience, because I want to hear about your impressions of South Africa, about moving there 5 years ago. I mean, apartheid is over technically, but how much is it still divided there?
It's still extremely divided. I mean, the legacy of apartheid is quite strong in South Africa, and a big issue in apartheid was land, right? That the whites took the black land, and the land was separated. There was the townships, the rural homelands, and then these sort of historically white areas, and you know, it's very hard to change where people are based. So you can still see people stuck. I mean, the townships are still largely black. I think I met one white person who lived there, a socialist. and then the historically white areas remain historically white. So it's quite separated. Though, of course, there have been major leaps and bounds as well. I mean, it's not legally, you know, still black kids can go to great schools now, and you know, people mix a lot more, but that old entrenched racial segregation is still happening today.
Is racism expressed among people of the same color? Do they feel like, you know, in their own group they can talk about other people in slighting ways?
I can only speak to my experience. Mm-hmm. My experience when I married to a white South African, and we moved back for a couple years to just, he wanted to start a little something in his country and wanted to reconnect with his family. So I immediately was sort of plunged into a well-off white community as kind of quote-unquote one of their own. And there's no culture of political correctness in South Africa like there is in America. So, yeah, I mean, I heard a lot of very blunt racist remarks. I also spent a lot of time in the black townships, maybe more time, and I did not find people to, and I think I was accepted in a way that I think I might have heard people saying racist things if they did have. I didn't hear very much, you know, anti-white sentiment in the townships, but I did hear a good amount of anti-black sentiment in the well-off areas.
You know, you can tell a lot about a place by its plumbing. And what did you see in the way of plumbing facilities, toilets in specific, for people of color out there in the townships?
Yeah, toilets are actually a huge issue. There have been things called the poo protests and the toilet wars in Cape Town, because people feel that 20 years after, you know, 20 plus years after the end of apartheid, they still have these little outhouses. There's still don't have proper plumbing. They still have, a lot of times they have these like standing sort of porta potties that serve an entire neighborhood, you know, these are, people have to trudge there when they're working early in the morning, and they get tipped over by criminals who are trying to steal cell phones. They'll reach in, take a cell phone out, somebody, you know, in the sludge of a toilet, just trying to get around. So this is actually a really big issue, and it's a problem the government faces, how to get toilets to people in townships.
Now, it seems like, as a white woman walking around in poor areas or driving around in poor areas, that the name Amy Beal gets mentioned a lot. I mean, she's a really well-known person in South Africa from the sounds of it.
She is. Yeah, she's very well-known. I'm not sure if it was mentioned to me because I was researching the story, or, you know, if it would have been mentioned otherwise, but she does loom large in the sort of collective consciousness.
Justine van der Leeuwen's book is called We Are Not Such Things. She's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. So you met Amy Beal's mom, Linda Beal, and you mentioned already there was some she was being quite generous and forgiving of the murderers of her daughter. Tell us about meeting Linda in the first place, though, and some of what you got from her on that initial discussion.
I mean, I spoke with Linda back and forth a while before I met her, because I was in South Africa and she was in America going between her. She has three surviving children going between their homes. And I just found her to be a fascinating person. She basically just told me, you know, about Amy, who she was. She was this really serious but also really fun person who was very dedicated to her principles, was very connected to helping bring democracy to post-colonial societies in Africa. She was an academic. And I think what led Linda and her late husband, Peter, to be so forgiving and to go to South Africa and to try to help was that they wanted to honor Amy's beliefs. So, you know, that she was the driving force, and I think she remains the driving force between a lot of what Linda still does.
What does Linda make of her status as what you call a figure of curiosity and controversy?
I mean, I can't say exactly. I mean, just that I think she just accepts that is what she, in fact, is. I don't think she's... my sense was not that Linda Beal is out to impress anybody or change who she is to suit anybody. She's doing what she believes and what she believes her daughter would have wanted her to do.
There's some real powerful writing in here, and the way in which you describe as you got to know more people and ask more questions about what had happened to Amy and what had happened to the people who killed her. As you write, the old narrative fell ill early on and perished. I mean, so you got to the point pretty quickly, it sounds like, that you realized, boy, this story is not what people put it out to be.
I'd actually been working about, I think I put that early in the book so that nobody thinks that they're going to get some neat and tidy answer. When they start reading the book, I don't want anyone to be disappointed at the end that there's not some, you can't tie up this story and say, there it is. But I think I'd been actually investigating for a year, and I thought I would write just the inspiring story of, you know, how the Beals, because what happened is the Beal family in addition to supporting the process that the men would get amnesty, they then became very close with two of the men convicted of killing Amy. They hired these men at the Amy Beale Foundation, which is run out of Cape Town, which now helps underprivileged kids in the township do after-school activities. And these men began to call them Makulu and Tatamkulu, which in their language means grandmother and grandfather. And I was going to tell that story, which itself has enough for a book. But after about a year, I ended up stumbling upon, basically accidentally, the question of, was this accepted narrative that has been told again and again, that has been polished into being, true at all? Are the men that were convicted the men who killed her? I stumbled upon another crime that I don't want to spoil for people, but that is, you know, that is probably connected to that crime that happened on that same day that was never reported. So that is how the book sort of unraveled the fabric of the story, and then I just started following the different threads.
Justine Vanderloo, and again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called We Are Not Such Things, The Murder of a Young America in a South African Township and the Search for Truth and Reconciliation. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. You might have thoughts about apartheid and its eventual undoing in South Africa and how complete that has been or not, and some thoughts about the story itself to share with us. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You do go way back in the book to European colonization. And how necessary is that to understand the now of South Africa?
Well, I'm not a historian. I really think I'm a storyteller and a writer. But it seemed to me impossible, especially for a foreign audience, to understand what happened to Amy if you didn't understand what happened to South Africa and how it sort of came to be. So that's kind of why, and I had to learn that to understand it, how to understand how the centuries of colonization and apartheid led to the kind of brute rage that would lead a mob of young people to take down a stranger that they didn't even know because of the color of her skin. I thought you really had to understand that to understand how Amy got there and how she got killed.
So a lot of the separations had been going on for centuries, but apartheid itself, how long was that actually in place?
Apartheid itself was in place for about 50, 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for hundreds of years since the first, white people landed on the Cape, it was coming to be. But the actual apartheid as a government system came to be in the 40s,
mm-hmm. Okay.
Ended in 1994.
From page one, you give street addresses like NY1 and NY25. I mean, to New Yorkers' eyes, this should be New York, but it's not. I mean, what do those terms mean?
These are native yards,
mm-hmm.
which is the way that townships were built by the apartheid government, and they considered them kind of a. They had a hope that they would be able to. They believed that the strife in South Africa was due to the fact that different people of different backgrounds were living together. And they thought, well, a great way to get rid of that is to just separate everybody into their own little area. And then we won't have to mix. Of course, their own area would be the best area, full of all the good stuff. Mm-hmm. And everyone else would live in worse areas. Indians lived in slightly worse areas. Colored people, which is mixed race, the term for mixed race in South Africa, would live in worse areas, and then the worst areas would be for black people, who in the Cape, the government actually had a dream that they wouldn't even need black people, and they could put them in these sort of fake countries that only they recognized called homelands.
Mm-hmm.
So when they built the townships, it was kind of an admission that they still needed that poor black labor, but they would keep it at a remove. And they built the streets, and they just called them the native yards. Because they, called black people the natives, and they just numbered them. And these things remain today. You know, slowly, the new government is trying to change the names.
And they actually give them names, and so they're not just
numbers.
Give them names of
luminaries from the liberation and famous people and names, in local language, in indigenous languages like Zulu and Xhosa. But people still refer to their, even if their street has been renamed, people are still referring to it as NY1 or NY21.
Mm-hmm. And it was on NY1 that Amy Beale was attacked. I mean, and how did you get such excruciating detail?
Yeah, maybe it is excruciating. I had a guide who I came upon quite accidentally, a brilliant guy named Mswabantu Noji. I called him Z. And he was an ex-militant who happened to know about the day of the attack, and I just went out to lunch with him. And he ended up knowing more about Guguletu and South Africa and the struggle than anyone I had met, and he became sort of my guide. We would go around Guguletu, the township, just knocking on doors. He would have ideas of who I might need to meet. I went through court transcripts and you know, would circle out names of people. Sometimes the name would be Miss A, because the witnesses who testified in court, if they were from the township, they didn't want to be identified by name because they were scared that there would be retribution. So they'd go Miss A, Miss B, Miss C. And then I would go to Z, my guide, and I would say, who do you think Miss A is? And we would kind of just go hunting around, and we would find Miss A, inevitably, because, you know, there's so much knowledge on those streets. But you can't look it up on a computer. You have to go kind of door to door.
Yeah, it sounds like a walking Google, really.
Yeah, he's a walking Google in Guguletu, yes.
Wow, that's a good way to put it. So what was it that Amy got into the middle of on that day?
That's sort of the question of the book. What was it? Was it a political protest? Was it, you know, a crime, just basically an out-of-control mob? What it was sort of officially is that a group of students who were from a militant offshoot of the ANC called the Pan-Africanist Congress, which believed that, so the ANC is, you know, believes in the Rainbow Nation, mm-hmm. and all colors together making up South Africa.
And that was Nelson Mandela's party.
That's Mandela's party. The PAC, which is an offshoot, believed in Africa for Africans, a black-led country for black Africans. They sort of have shifted their focus a little now and say, if you consider yourself an African, that's good enough for us. But so these kids were at this rally at a school, and they got really pumped up, and they were sort of overturning government property and protesting and going through the townships and taking trains and marching around. And they were chanting One Settler, One Bullet. They'd robbed some trucks. They would call it repossessing. And Amy had just sort of bad luck, but she had been warned not to go into township, but, I don't think anyone foresaw this. Mm-hmm. And she just ended up driving down in very thick traffic, and her white face was what they saw. And somebody shouted, settler, settler. And they converged upon her car. I don't think she could drive. A brick went through the windshield, and nothing her friends could say or do could convince this mob to let her go.
Justine van der Leeuwen is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is We Are Not Such Things. Even by South African standards at the time, Justine, was this a shocking case?
It was absolutely shocking. It was shocking because it was sort of the sheer irony of the victim. Amy was in South Africa to study the country, and she was helping women, black. Nobody knew how to vote because they had never, only white people had been allowed to vote. So black people, with the election coming up that Mandela would eventually win, had to learn, many of them, had to learn, how do you cast a vote? How do you exercise your rights? Amy was really interested in this, and she was doing voter education, and she was, she had, in her high school graduation, had worn across her cap in tape, Free Mandela. She was very pro-ANC. She was studying with major ANC figures when she, it was extremely ironic that she was the person that they ended up killing as a settler. That, and also, you know, she came from America, and so it was a huge case in South Africa at the time.
You mentioned in the book and just a little while ago that people bring up Amy Beale when you're a white woman walking in townships in South Africa. So 20 years later, I mean, visiting some of the same areas, was there ever any particular concern on your part about your own safety?
There wasn't, and it was kind of funny because I lived in a fairly well-off area by the ocean. And I spent my days in Guguletu. And usually people would feel quite safe in the area by the ocean and quite frightened in Guguletu. But it came to be that ultimately I almost had an opposite experience. I was living alone some of the time in the nicer area, because my husband had moved to another country for work. I would eventually join him. So I was quite scared because South Africa has this sort of violent crime issue, and I would kind of come home with my panic button in my hand. I would sometimes call the armed guard because almost all South Africans who can afford it have an armed guard company because they don't believe the police are reliable enough, and the armed guard will come and usher you into your home. And yet when I was in Guguletu, because I knew so many people and I'd been there for so long and I trusted the people as my friends, I felt quite protected.
Interesting. We have much more to talk about with Justine van der Leeuwen. Her book is called We Are Not Such Things, The Murder of a Young American, a South African Township, and the Search for Truth and Reconciliation. We'll come back and talk more with her on the Jefferson Exchange. And if you'd like to join us, we will take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Been on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the American journalist Justine van der Leeuwen. She lived a long time in South Africa and wrote about a famed crime there in her book, We Are Not Such Things. The crime was the murder by mob of Amy Beal, a white American working in South Africa in 1993, the waning days of apartheid. Four people were convicted of her murder and sent to prison, and then the Truth and Reconciliation Commission took up the case in 1997 and shortened the men's sentences, and the story fell apart upon further examination by Justine, which is the exhaustive look at the stories and the people of this particular set of circumstances. You can join us on the Exchange as we talk about South Africa and this particular case, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So we already talked about Easy Nofamila just a bit. Didn't mention it up to this point, though, how much time you spent with him. But first, how elusive was he as you tried to meet him?
Easy was the hardest person to get an interview with. He was almost like a top celebrity, except that he would always tell me, "I'll absolutely meet with you anytime," and then he would always fail to show up. If I were lucky, he would fail to show up and call me at least. If I weren't lucky, he would just never pitch. Eventually, I kind of cornered him, tracked him down, and we ended up talking, and at some point my persistence paid off and he became quite intrigued by my project, and I think he started to want his story told.
I love the observation, "I knew Easy." Do we really know anybody at all? And you got to know him fairly well. He had been in the media many times. How was he often portrayed, and what did he think of the portrayals?
He was portrayed in different ways at different times, you know, depending on what point the country was in. You know, of course, when he initially was arrested, he was portrayed as a radical youth, and he did nothing to dissuade people of that. Later, when he had become close with Linda Beale, I think he's portrayed largely as reformed and symbolic of the possibility of, you know, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission healing people. He wasn't really, I don't think he was very concerned. He didn't read the news about him. He would meet a journalist if he was asked to, as a favor to somebody, or maybe because he felt like it. And that was kind of it. His life was not, his life took place in a totally different sphere. He wasn't reading, you know, the New York Times to see what they said about him. He might talk to them if he felt like it, and then he would sort of move on.
What sense did you get from any anger and resentment that Easy or his family or friends felt about how they'd been treated during the days of apartheid?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because it's something that I've tried to understand. There's a lot of acceptance of things having been that way, that is maybe too generous of some black South Africans, especially older people. Izzy's father, Wowo, was a very important part of my understanding of the past and the present for somebody. He had gone through so much. He lived through, you know, so many changes in history. And I remember him telling me about in his childhood, his whole life had been sort of fractured by apartheid. His father had had to leave their rural homestead, go find work in the cities. They were, you know, very poor. He had not learned to read until he was much older. He had to teach himself because he hadn't been able to go to school. When he moved to Cape Town, finally his parents managed to bring the children there. He lived in squalor. And eventually, when the government decided that colored areas had to be separated from black areas, he and his family had their house basically dismantled, thrown into the back of a truck, driven across a highway, and dumped in another field. And I remember saying to him, well, what did you do? And he said, nothing. And I said, well, what did you feel? And he said, you can't feel nothing if you want to survive. You couldn't complain if you wanted to survive. So they just rebuilt and went on. And later, he worked for many years as a groundskeeper at an insurance company and retired in, I think, 1997. And his pension was something like $15,000 after, you know, 40 years of work. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, you can't do nothing with that money. You can't. You really can't. There's nothing you can do. And when I think of it, I want to cry, but I try not to think of it because I'm alive now and I'm just moving on. That was kind of his, he wasn't angry. He was, in a way, resigned because he had no choice but to be.
Huh. So how did Easy get in the middle of the events on that day leading up to Amy Beale's death?
Easy went to the rally. Mm-hmm. Easy marched down the street, and Easy was part of the mob that attacked Amy. So goes the official narrative. The book questions much of this and does not come to a conclusion, but I think, at least for me, in a way, the lack of truth was kind of the solution. That was the answer about South Africa. There is no one truth there. The quest was the truth. But yeah, the idea is officially Easy was a student, you know, a youth member of this mob who took her down. But the question is, was he really?
And how much detail did he get into with you? Did he sort of skirt around the edges of it? Or did he tell you specifically, I did this, I picked up a brick, any of that stuff?
In the book, you'll see that he told me, and then he untold me, and then he told me, and then he untold me. Huh. Pretty much everything.
Wow. So you did talk to the police who investigated, and what sense did they give you, not of the details, but of their mission in a case like that?
I spoke to the ex-detective, the lead detective on the case.
Ilmar Picker,
and he I found to be an absolutely fascinating character as well, and I think We Are Not Such Things, the title, though Easy said it, applies to most of the people that sort of star in this book, because nobody was really who I thought they would be. I really expected Ilmar Picker to be this grand evildoer, this villain, and he was a really complex, you know, quite sensitive person. I mean, I'm not speaking to what he did when he was in the police force, but just to who he was, and as you know, as a person today, and my experience speaking with him at length many times, he was interesting because he had been after. I remember walking away from meeting with him, my first meeting with him, and him saying, you know, the four guys they got were just a weak consolation prize, and I dismissed that. And later, I came to see that he really had a better idea of what happened than I had sort of given him a credit for. He of course was just the police. He didn't prosecute. He wasn't part of, you know, he was the order. He was not the law.
So did it seem like at first that it was one of those go round of the usual suspects kinds of things?
I think it took him a long time to round up anybody because nobody would talk to white cops then. So it was a lot of hard work. I'm not sure if it was the usual suspects. It's much more complicated than that. I mean, but yes, there's probably an element of that to it. But since the township is such an ecosystem, there's so much more going on behind why the people who were rounded up were rounded up. And I'm also not saying I think that there's an element of guilt there as well. I'm not saying that they weren't necessarily there.
Okay. I'm curious to know how big a role you think international media coverage might have played in fixing a narrative of Amy's death.
I think international media coverage certainly pressured the government to act. They knew right away that this was a big problem for them because, you know, they were trying to usher in a new day without civil war, and this was not good news. And they knew that it would be big news. But more likely, what helped solidify a narrative here was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which sought to, you know, build the nation and had a very specific mandate that people really had to fit into in order to have a chance for amnesty. So I think possibly the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was, in a way, made history for South Africa, reshaped history.
Did her story become a political tool as well? I mean, did people make use of the Amy Beal story for their own political purposes as apartheid's true end approached?
I mean, the ANC, the PAC, which was the group that the men who were convicted was part of, was sort of a thorn in the ANC's side. Not a serious contender, but, you know, they got some angry people and some people with more radical beliefs on their side. And I think the ANC did take Amy in as their own, and they did use this crime to illustrate the inadequacies of the PAC and how they were violent and they were not to be trusted. So it was used in that way.
We have not talked about whether you talked to any of the other people who were charged with the murder. There were three other men, and you spent a lot of time with Easy, but did you get any access, any appreciable access to the other three?
There were eight men.
Eight men altogether, okay.
Initially. Four were let go, and four were convicted. And I talked to all of them, yeah, and at some length. So I had to do a lot of tracking down, especially of the men that were, that's not exactly true because several of them were dead of the people that were released. But everyone who was still alive, I did track down deep in the township. and in one case, in prison.
In prison. Okay, so you mentioned that the old narrative fell ill early on and perished. I mean, was it partly from talking to these men that you realized that the stories just didn't match up?
It was actually just from talking to Mzi, my guide that I mentioned earlier. We were just sitting there at our first meeting, and he was sort of just going over the day for me. I was trying to just find some more detail, some more color to the story, sort of figure out exactly what he knew about what happened. He himself didn't witness it, but of the men that were, when I said there were eight of the men that were arrested, the four that were released, he knew quite well, and one of them was his brother. So he was kind of telling me his knowledge. He was just kind of going into it, and he said sort of casually, as he was telling me sort of the official story, then he stopped. He said, no, that's not quite what happened. Actually, something different happened. And I said, what? Are you sure? He said, yes, I know it's not the accepted narrative, but this is what we know. And the story that I did come upon, it didn't come as a surprise to people in the township. Many of them said, yeah, we heard about this. Okay, yeah, there's the question. You know, nobody had talked to them. It had just been sort of this machine that kept going.
This has been such an odyssey. I mean, all the work that you put into and all the miles on cars and feet, I'm sure. I mean, do you think about still Amy and Easy every day?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I think about the story. I think about what it taught me about human beings and about approaching people with an open mind. It's really informed the way I think about humanity in general, because although it is a story about South Africa, I found it to be a really universal story about the idea of these entrenched narratives, the idea of sort of who is the other and how close are they really, what do you really share with somebody when you sit down and talk to them.
Do you think that the ending of apartheid itself has made changes in the way people view the narrative? Because, I mean, obviously people can change over the course of 20-odd years now, and if their own views of themselves have changed a bit over time.
I think I think when you, say, go before the country and you're lauded as a you know, a symbol of peace, a symbol of reconciliation, when you're understood as a political person, when you're known as a hero. I'm talking about Linda or Easy. I mean, you start to understand yourself that way as well. So I do think that the people in this story inevitably came to understand themselves in a way through how they were portrayed.
Oh, so their own experiences got filtered through other people's visions of or views of that experience.
I would imagine that would happen to anybody. It would happen to me, to you. I think, I mean, I can't say for sure, but that was my sense that, yes, they took on, in a way, the identity. Easy said once to me, I was in the shoes of a soldier, then I stepped out, now I'm in the shoes of somebody who loves peace. You know, he kind of understood himself through these stories that were told about him.
And the Amy Beale Foundation, is that still going strong? I noticed there's even a high school named after Amy now.
There is a high school in New Mexico named after her, and she grew up in New Mexico. And the Amy Beale Foundation in South Africa, yeah, it's running after-school programs for underprivileged kids in the townships still today.
Mm-hmm. Wow, so much work that went into this book. Are you working on something else now, or are you taking a bit of a breather?
taking a bit of a breather, moved back to the States, and just thinking about some article ideas right now. Then I hope to find another epic investigation.
Well, this really is an epic. You have nailed it right there. The book is called We Are Not Such Things, The Murder of a Young American, a South African Township, and the Search for Truth and Reconciliation. Justine van der Leeuwen wrote it and joined us on The Exchange today. Justine, thank you.
Thank you so much.